Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Coming up, an interview with Bill Sharp, the Shack Attack keyboardist. They were huge in the 80s. They still have a massive following, still on tour, and he's made a new album with Lee John. Really fascinating guy, Bill Sharp.
Unless you're really focused and driven, you kind of need somebody behind you to make you do it. And I was lucky to have that, particularly in my mother. And they said, Nightbird's album's gone in at number 4. I said, really? Is that good? And they said, it's good, it's good. You really need to give up your day job. We were just a bunch of musicians. We had no concept of fashion whatsoever. The point of the track as well was, at the time, there was this thing, a big thing about whistles. Everybody at these all day has had whistles. So in the song, there's loads of gaps, so everybody could blow the whistles to the beat. At the end of it, one of us said to Jacques, we said, that wine's fantastic. He said, we'd love to take some back. He said, well, we can't because you've drunk it all.
Now, stay with me for that interview. It's a really fascinating interview, talking about the period of the 80s where Shack Attack were massive. They still perform today. They still have a large fan base, and Bill has made a new album with Lee John, and we'll be talking about that also in the interview. Now, please subscribe. It helps me, and it allows you to hear when I've posted something new on the channel. Bill Sharp, welcome. First of all, what sort of music and creativity were you brought up around?
As a child growing up, my family were all very musical. Everyone played the piano. It was kind of that, showing my age now, but it's sort of like late 50s, early 60s, really, when I was started to sort of learn the piano. I started learning when I was 7. My mum and sister were sort of more kind of classical, but my dad was, he couldn't read music, but he had a great ear, but he loved jazz. So he would listen to Ellis Larkins, Oscar Peterson, all those sort of guys. And so I grew up listening to that kind of stuff, and he played by ear. So he could hear a tune and pick it up really quickly. So my earliest memories of just at Christmas and other times, if the family came around, other family members, everybody played something, which was great. Somebody played the cello, somebody played a clarinet, somebody played something else. And so there'd be a bit of jazz, a bit of classical. So it was a very musical environment that I grew up in.
I mean, our ages aren't that far apart. And I remember my mother wanted me to do and go to piano lessons. And in a sense, I don't think she really pushed me, but in a sense, I don't think it was fully my decision. But it sounds like with you, it was much more of a sort of organic decision because you were in that type of household. Was it your choice to go and have piano lessons? Was that a natural progression?
Not at all. I had to be forced. I had a very, my mother was very, very good, actually. She wasn't pushy, but I actually went to a school not far from where I live now, years ago, back in the early 60s. And the piano teacher there was a lady called Doris Ragg. who's probably long since left this earth. But she was quite scary. And if I used to do scales, and if I got them wrong, she used to rap me over the knuckles with a ruler, which is not really the best thing to do. So if you're learning the piano, so she scared me into it. And then when I started to play a bit more, my mum used to bribe me like a penny a scale to play. So there was a lot of effort went into it. And then I think when I got to grade five, and then at school, you know, if you could start doing something like that, play a few tunes, you became a bit more popular. Because I wasn't sort of like I was a small child, so you know, you could get beaten up a little bit here and there. So the music became a bit of a, like people say about comedy, you know, it becomes a sort of way of stop getting bullying, really, to be honest. So then it became when I could play for myself and join. Then of course, you don't have to be forced to do it. But it's the point, and a lot of people say the same thing. It's the point where you start, and then you say, "Oh, I really don't want to do the scales." You, unless you're really focused and driven, you kind of need somebody behind you to make you do it. And I was lucky to have that, particularly in my mother.
I mean, I remember when I was playing the piano and I got to grade five and I was obsessed with Bridge Over Troubled Water. I'm just a little bit younger than you. So I was obsessed with that. And my mother hated it so much, she sold the piano.
Yeah, it's a wonderful piece of piano. I remember the, you know, the guy Larry Nechtel who played that. He was a top session musician. He was actually a member of the band Bread, which shows my complete sort of knowledge of trivia. I'm a bit of a nerd like that, but it's a wonderful piano intro. I remember Paul Simon talking about saying that he liked Larry Nechtel because he also came from a white guy, but he came from a gospel background, so it has got that kind of gospel thing, that intro to that song. And it's one of the classic piano intros to a song, I think. Really, it's beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you went on to study music at Birmingham University, I believe. What did that experience of being at university, not just, you know, learning music and getting a degree in music, but what did that experience of going into this other society give you, do you think?
Well, it's definitely you're walking into a complete sense of independence for me, because obviously when I went to school from the age of sort of 14 to 18, I was what they call it, I was a day boy. So I you know, I was living at home, which was great. You know, I mean, my mother and I got on really well together. And but then obviously going off to university, you're suddenly, well, you're thrown into firstly you're thrown into I mean, you know, it's quite scary really, if you're just walking into this huge sort of the place of education. And also you're surrounded by people who are as good, if not probably better than I was. I mean, I love being sort of doing classical music and training, but my heart always really, I loved the Beatles and I wanted to play in bands. And so at school I was playing in bands, and then at university, the first thing I did, having sort of registered and then sort of got into doing the classes and stuff, was to find out where, you know, where the bands were, so I could go and join a band to play. And I remember the first year, at the end of the first year, I didn't do so well because I was out playing. My tutor said to me, he said, "Bill," I can't remember if he called me Bill or William, but he said, "You have a choice to make." He said, "You're either going to go play in bands or you're going to want to finish the 2 years at university." And I thought about it, and I thought I really should finish the 2 years at uni, really. But it's a great thing to do. And you know, at the time I was just doing music, and I thought I had no idea what I was going to do at the end of it. And of course, when you get to the end of 3 years, which is probably true of so many people, you think, "I've got to get a job, I've got to do something else, or stay in education, whatever else." So, but the experience there was great. You know, Birmingham I was there from 72 to 75, so lots of interesting things going on, you know, bombs exploding and all that kind of stuff. So it was an interesting, and obviously it was the ball ring, you know, it was all new architecture and all that kind of stuff. So it was an interesting place to be. Lots of music coming through. I went to see loads of music, like bands like King Crimson. I saw Bowie a few times. So I was very much into kind of the rock stuff then. But the university as a whole is it's a great thing, and I was very glad that I stayed the 3 years.
I mean, you mentioned Bowie, and for me in 72, I think it was, that Bowie sort of provided a world where I felt I could belong, a world away from my parents. Okay, so I was 13 in 72, but it was, that's what music initially provided for me. I just wondered if there was an artist, a musician who sort of signified almost like coming to my world away from the world you were in.
In those days, I mean, I was a big Bowie fan. I saw the Ziggy Stardust tour twice, I think. I did see him later when he did the Let's Dance album as well, which was there was all those different images he went through. But Bowie, obviously, I said the Beatles, stuff like that. But in the '70s, I mean, I was a bit of also into a bit of prog rock as well. And as a pianist, I was a massive fan of Keith Emerson because I loved what he played. But he also, and the fact he was kind of, well, I say showbiz, but what he did, I shouldn't frankly say what he did with his organ was amazing. You know, all the knife, I mean, you look back at it, you think, my God, it was so bonkers. But underneath it all, he was a great player, but he was also, there was a lot of jazz in his playing as well, which I liked a lot because it was always Rick Wakeman or Keith Emerson. And I liked Emerson because he was a bit jazzy, you know, both great keyboard players, but in different ways. So music was like I probably listened to it, to say at uni again. I mean, I had to listen to classical music, but I was always listening to whatever was going on sitting in my room. And music, it just does, you know, if you're going through bad times, you know, I'd stick on the Doors or whatever music I was listening to, and it would just take you off and you could escape from whatever problems you were going through. So I guess I was very much in those days still really into, I was very much into kind of rock, prog rock kind of stuff. A little bit of jazz because I'd heard a lot of jazz, but I hadn't kind of got to that stage yet.
But it was always that sort of mid to late 70s because I went to university at 77 and I remember being mad about George Benson, the Crusaders. And of course, there are other bands that, you know, that have been, well, they've been going a bit longer. Weather Report, for example, Herbie Hancock. Yeah. So what role did these artists play in the development of your musicianship and where you wanted to go?
Well, I think the turning point for me was a friend, an old school friend of mine, because I'd been listening to, obviously, say, Emerson, all that kind of stuff, Ray Manzarek with the Doors, all these great keyboard players. And then he played me, said, you've got to listen to this, got to listen to this. And it was an album called Hymn of the Seventh Galaxy by Return to Forever with Chick Corea. And I listened to it and I thought, my God, this is a whole new, the way he was playing the electric piano, the synthesizers, all that sort of stuff was another level of playing. And then slowly I got into Herbie Hancock and, as you say, Weather Report, all those sorts of guys. And when you mentioned George Benson in 77, I remember going to the Albert Hall. He just released the Breezin album. And I went to see him. And when he was just sort of breaking out, obviously he had all those years of being this consummate jazz musician. But then it suddenly started breaking out into a more sort of, not pop really, but jazz pop kind of thing. And that was fantastic to hear that band play live. So through the sort of, I guess, mid-70s, really, then I suddenly discovered all this other wonderful music I'd really listened to. Although I did, when I went to the Isle of Wight Festival in 1970, I did see Miles Davis play there. And the keyboard players were Chick Corea and Keith Jarrett. I mean, you look back at the band, it's extraordinary. And Jack DeJohnette. And so I was kind of there to see the Doors. So Miles Davis went over me a little bit. But when I listened back to it, I mean, it's a fantastic set. But so I guess mid-70s was really the time when I just really got into all the people that you've mentioned. Crusaders, of course, Joe Sample, all those wonderful players that I listened to over the years.
You did also mention that, you know, it's almost like you nearly went off into a band, or should I finish my university degree? And I think we're both of an era where it was like, especially from our parents, it was like you have to do that. And then when you left, you went to work at the BBC, and this is where the juggling started to take place between, you know, two things in a sense, your love of making music, and also, I'm sure, because, you know, it sounds like the job at the BBC was pretty interesting.
It was great. I was very lucky. I mean, I think there might have been, I don't know if it was real nepotism, but when I went for my BBC interview, my sister before me, she was 10 years older than me, but she was also a great influence in my life. And she was started off as a studio manager, which was a posh name for a sound engineer, really. And so I went for my interview. I happened to mention her name. The guy interviewed me, said, oh, Judy Sharp. Yeah, she's, you know, and it seemed to just sort of like help a little bit, I think, in terms of the choosing process, because they only picked, I think, 12 or 18 people out of a lot of people. And so I got a letter saying they'd offered me the job. And I was like, wow, that's fantastic. I'd also had an offer from a friend to go and play in a band in Australia. So I remember sitting talking to my father, actually. Sadly, he was ill at the time. He didn't stay alive for a lot longer. But I said, I'm not quite sure what to do, really. I want to play in this band, but also I've got this job offer at the Beeb. So I don't think whether I did it or not, but I either phoned or wrote them and said, is there any chance I could start next year? which is absolutely bonkers. I don't remember getting a reply or anything. And my dad just said, I really think you should take the job. It's an opportunity and you can carry on doing music and see what happens. You know, very sound advice. So I took the job. And in those days, we trained at the Langham, which is now the Langham Hotel in Portland Place. And I got 3 months training as well, because I hadn't really had a lot of experience being in band stuff. I was playing, but I didn't really know the sort of recording side of it so much. So I got acoustic training, all that kind of stuff. And then they threw you into working in all sorts of different genres in radio, because I only ever worked in radio. But as it turned out, it was the right decision. And I was there for 6 years working in drama, classical, current affairs, pop. So I did everything, world service. And it was a fantastic experience. So I'm really glad that I made that decision.
Was this the period where you were also in the band Tracks?
Kind of, yeah. Yeah, that was the band that I'd met, or I'd been introduced to. There was our Shack Attack drummer, actually, a guy called Roger O'Dell. Roger and Lorraine in Bishop Stortford, where I was born and grew up, they were kind of like the Johnny Dankworth and Cleo Lane of Bishop Stortford. And if you got summoned to go and see them and maybe even play in a band, a friend of mine said, oh, Rod's heard about you, he'd like to meet you. So he said, I'm thinking of starting this band called Tracks. We're just going to do jazz rock covers like John McLaughlin, Weather Report, all that stuff. And he was also playing in the evenings, as his living was playing in a mecca band called the Cat's Whiskers in Streatham, where they did, you know, all these sort of like chart stuff before DJs and stuff. And the bass player in the band was a guy called Trevor Horn, who, you know, obviously went on to be quite a well-known producer. So the Tracks was originally myself, Roger, Keith Winter, our guitarist, and Trevor Horn. That's how that started. But at that time, I was still working at the BBC. And they used to have this system. It's called training sessions. And on a Sunday, you could book out Studio 4 and 5, which were the pop studios. You could book them out for training sessions. So I thought, what a great opportunity to record. By then I started writing sort of original material for the band. So we went in three or four of these training sessions where some of my colleagues would record it. And we actually made an album using the BBC's training sessions at Maiden Vale while I'm still working there. So that was how Tracks evolved. And we actually sort of recorded some stuff. And then obviously Tracks disbanded. Trevor went on. He was going out with Tina Charles, who had a big hit with Love to Love. And he was her MD. And so that changed. He left. But we carried on as Tracks. So, yeah, that sort of was the starting point where I was kind of doing two different things at the BBC at the same time, which was brilliant, because it's the kind of organisation that enabled you to be able to do that in those days.
You know, as we grow up, we're in a sense, we're often fulfilling partially our parents' dreams of what they want for us. And I interviewed Dr. Robert of the Blow Monkeys recently, and he said something to me which I found extremely fascinating, because he said that when his father died, it gave him the freedom for him to do what he wanted. And you mentioned that your father was very ill and it was, you know, in the later years of his life. I know this is a weird question, but was it a sort of an opening up for you to the world? Because that idea of what your father may have wanted was then gone, and it was only about what you wanted.
I guess so, yeah. But he was, I mean, if I'd have decided to go another route, I think he would have been supportive. His thing was very much, you know, the security of a proper job in those days. And what are you going to do? Like most parents would have said in those days, you know, playing in a band, where's that going to lead to? And to be honest, maybe going to Australia would have been the worst thing to do. But when I think of my father, actually, I mean, he died in 75, 76. So he never saw what happened in the future. But I like to think that he would have been proud of what I achieved. I think he would have liked the music, actually, in a way, because, you know, there's just a little bit of a jazz influence in there and some piano playing and stuff like that. So I think he would have been, I know my mum my mum, obviously, she was around when all the success started, and she was really proud, which was great. My family were very supportive, so it was lovely having that. A lot of people don't have. I know so many people who say, you know, if only I'd had this, and if I had the opportunity to do that. And without that, you know, a lot of people need that real inner strength to be able to fight all of that sort of apathy in a way. But I was lucky that I had that support. So I think in a way, I'm not sure it freed me up. I would have probably just carried on doing it anyway. But I was sad that he didn't sort of see the way that it progressed, which was sad. So I like to think, you know, he might have seen it looking down kind of thing in that idealistic way.
So then Shack Attack came about from a fusion of two bands, didn't it? From Trax and from Cat's Whiskers. What was the difference in the bands musically? And what were the discussions at the beginning about what you wanted to do?
Well, with Trax, I mean, it was very much Roger's band. Trevor was, he was quite, you know, I could see, you know, weirdly enough, we actually did one session at Maida Vale when Trevor was still in the band. And he sort of took it over a little bit. And I thought, gosh, you know, he's a weird thing to think, but I thought he'd probably make quite a good producer.
You were right.
years before any of that was happening, he had that kind of vision, or whatever you like to think that producers can sort of bring to an album. So my sort of part was, in the early days, the Trax was very much play the tunes. But then in the band, my thing was, I just love writing music particularly. That's always been something I love doing. So I was writing a lot of stuff for Trax, kind of just very, very much influenced by, you know, those sort of artists that we've talked about. So I think my contribution really for the Trax thing was probably the compositions. And in terms of the Trax and the Cat's Whiskers, Trax was basically just fun. We used to play, there was a club, we used to do lunchtime gigs in Bishop's Stortford, a place called Triad, which is kind of like an art centre. And we just do free lunchtime gig, playing all that kind of music, with Roger would do like a 10-minute drum solo. And it was really, really incredibly self-indulgent. But people had come along, and it was a social, 50% social thing. And then one of the guys that helped us, he took a hat round just for a little bit of beer money and stuff. So that was just for fun. Obviously, the Cat's Whiskers was the guy's work. So they were having to learn all the tracks of the day. Not only that, but I played on a few, but they were all also playing all those Pick of the Pops albums you used to go into Woolworths and buy. So most of those were done by the guys in the band at the Cat's Whiskers, which Roger and Trevor played on a lot of those. And always had a girl with a bikini on the front. But, you know, that was what there was then. So it was musically, and the way it worked was very different. And I guess the real kind of pivot and between the two bands was Roger, because he was and Trevor in the early days, but he played in both bands. The guy who was the MD of the band at the Cat's Whiskers was a guy called Nigel Wright, who came down one day to Stortford, and he'd heard a few tunes that I'd written. And he said, we've been listening actually to, it was a song by a pianist called Rodney Franklin called In the Groove. And he said, you know, I listened to it, I thought, that's a great track. He said, can you do sort of something like that, like a British version of the instrumental thing? So I as the writer, I just came up with a few ideas. And one of the tunes I came up, we went into studio and we recorded three tracks, which was the first how Shack Attack really started, in a studio called Majestic in Clapham. And the first of those songs was a song called Steppin', which was a piano instrumental thing. It didn't sound anything like the groove, really, but it was that influence of what was going on at the time. And then that's how it all started, really.
I mean, it's interesting because an instrumental track didn't get really any play in those days, but this got onto Capital Radio, didn't it?
Well, it did, actually. I'm not quite sure how, why, because we also, the point of the track as well was, at the time, there was this thing, a big thing about whistles. Everybody at these all day has had whistles. So in the song, there's loads of gaps, so everybody could blow the whistles to the beat. So obviously, which isn't a great thing to have played on radio, because if there's loads of stops, somebody tunes in a gap and they'll think nothing's happening on the song. So it was an unusual thing to happen. But then, I think it was put out on a white label. Then Polydor, one of the guys came to a gig. He picked it up, and as I say, we just got a little bit of airplay because that was kind of the underground thing that was happening at the time, I think. And then that slowly, it was that whole thing of, like years of in the days when record companies supported you. And Polydor, I have to say, the guy called Alan Sizer at Polydor's, he supported us for 2 years before we had our first hit, which these days I think wouldn't really happen. But they had that idea that, let's see how they go. And fortunately, they hung in there with us.
Did you have to make many creative compromises because of the financial costs that would have been incurred in making a first album, Driving Hard?
No, I think on the early records, we didn't make any compromises at all, because what we had to do was make a single. We didn't get an album deal till we'd had four singles out. So we just had to find the money to record a single, which wasn't a fortune to find. So musically, we just sort of did what we wanted to do. I mean, it was it became slowly, as the things went along, I don't know if it became more commercial, but it was just the tunes that I was writing. I just thought, well, this, sort of nice piano melody, but a little bit of hint of jazz in there, bit of jazz funk, whatever else. But no, I think the first album, for the early years of Shack Attack, we just kind of did what we wanted to do, which was really nice, actually.
You just mentioned that it was the first few singles really didn't get very far. They were outside the top 50, but you were still sort of bubbling, as it were. There were still things happening, which I think would have been the thing that would have kept you going. But it was
we had a great following. We had built up a big following, which was great. But just sort of to interrupt, the Feels Like the Right Time, which was our second single, actually went to number 41. So we were just on the outside of the top 40. And we actually did in those days, they used to do they weren't quite sure which track was going to go where. So we went into the Top of the Pop studio and we recorded that song with a view that maybe it might get played on Top of the Pop. So we were very excited, but it didn't get into the top 40. So they had Eddie Grant was picked instead of us, and we were all absolutely gutted at the time. So to use the gutted, use that familiar phrase. But and then, of course, after that, it took quite a while to get back in and have another chance at the top 40. So even then, they thought, well, it went to 41, so we'll put another single out. Then there was another single. So a lot of record companies thought, oh, well, they didn't make it onto Top of the Pops, let's just give up. So they did hang in there, which was great.
I mean, but it was with Easier Said Than Done, I think, that the actual Top of the Pops initiation proper started. Yeah. What, when I talked to Lee John, who we're obviously going to talk about with you later, what was interesting, he said that when Top of the Pops came up, it was just a few days before, and they went into massive preparation mode, like, how are we going to use this? And obviously, he was extremely flamboyant, and his performance was very flamboyant. But I watched yours today on YouTube, and those red trousers are pretty tight as well. Don't go away. There's more with Bill Sharp coming up. Just want to remind you to please subscribe. It helps me. It's really useful, and it allows you to find out when I've posted something new on the channel. Now, if you like the interview with Bill Sharp, you'll definitely like the interviews that I've already done with Lee John. So please check them out. And also, there's another interview on the channel that you might want to check out, Carl McIntosh from Loose Ends. But yeah, let's get back to the story of Shack Attack and Bill Sharp.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I mean, I can only say from all our points of view, we probably did exactly the opposite. I mean, that's what I look back and I think I was wearing, I think, white boots with red trousers and a black and white shirt. We had no concept of fashion whatsoever, unlike Lee and everybody. We were just a bunch of musicians. So and the girls came on, they were in their little flouncy outfits, and I think Keith, our guitarist, wearing a red boiler suit, Roger's wearing, it was just, just great. I mean, it really was. Keith, our guitarist, always used to say, we became successful in spite of the way we looked, because we just hadn't got a clue. Maybe that was part of the charm of it, I don't know. And hopefully, the record did well because people liked the music. They weren't so bothered what we looked like. But it was, it was a very, very different thing to imagine. I mean, we did then, of course, after we had a few hits, the record company, people then started to think, we better stylize these guys a bit. So we started to get a bit of advice from, various fashion people and everything. But those early days, I mean, really the first two big hits we had, I mean, we hadn't got a clue, really.
Did your life change in any way? Because Top of the Pops, it's hard to sort of think of it in this way, but Top of the Pops of that era changed lives overnight. You would be recognizable the next day from appearance on Top of the Pops. Was it like that? Did it change your life?
A bit. I mean, we weren't sort of like a Spandau Ballet or a Duran Duran. We weren't instantly so recognizable. But where I lived, and well, I was still, weirdly enough, at that time, I was still living at home and I was still working for the BBC. So that, the amazing thing is I still had a day job until I think Nightbirds became a hit. So through that time, I was still working at the Beeb. So that was interesting. So, it changed my life in the sense that I remember, I go to the dentist and people go, it's him, he's on Top of the Pop sort of thing. But nothing like Michael Jackson or the guys that have got a massive profile. So it didn't make a huge difference. I mean, I like to think that, we didn't change too much with the success. I mean, it's hard to remember, really. I don't think I became too big-headed or whatever else. But it certainly made a difference in terms of work and the amount of work we were getting, because then suddenly, boff, we were on, twice on Top of the Pops. The Easier Said Than Done was in the charts for about 3 months. It had legs, that track. And so then we were starting to fill venues, and the venues are getting bigger, that whole sort of thing. So that part really did change a lot, which was fantastic. We'd start playing Hammersmith Odeon, Hammersmith Palais. The one place in London I'd love to have played, which I've never played at, was the Albert Hall. I'd have loved to do a gig there. I've been to watch so many shows there, but we never played there. But it was very, very exciting times. And also, Top of the Pops studio was it was a melting pot of so much different music. I think the charts then were so varied. You'd have us, you'd have Ian Gillan doing some rock, you'd have John and Vangelis, and you'd have some electro, you'd have some new romantic. So it was a very, very sort of very varied kind of music at the time. So you just get to meet all sorts of different people, which was great, And there was a little bit of friendly competition between the bands, and they'd be going, it's a bit like Spinal Tap, and they meet another band, and they're behind their backs, they're going like, thank you. Spinal Tap, to me, is one of the funniest movies ever, because it's just so well observed, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's spot on.
Was it weird going back into the BBC? I know you left shortly afterwards, but going back into the BBC the day after Top of the Pops. Can you remember that day? And because you'd been working with artists at the BBC and suddenly you were one of the artists.
No, it was a very weird thing. I was doing both things. And, everybody was so supportive. I used to work with doing Radio 2 sessions at the time with the BBC, the Radio Big Band and Concert Orchestra and stuff like that. And they said, "Oh, Bill, you know, well, it's fantastic." There was none. Nobody was like, "Well, he's still working here. How come he's on top of the pop?" sort of thing. Everybody was so supportive, and particularly the guys that worked there. You know, I was great friends. I used to work a lot with John Peel, who I used to do his show, he was him and his producer John Walters. The two of them were really supportive. The ironic thing is that after I think one or two shows, they'd invited John Peel to come back and compare it. So I'm again still working at the Beeb. I remember we'd done his show, and we went together. We went down to the top of the Pop Studios because we were on it, and then he did his first intro and he said, "And here's my mate Bill Sharp, wearing a terrible shirt," something like that's what he used to say. So he developed this little thing because we were sort of still working together. And then I remember walking into the studio to record one of his shows, and him and his producer Walters, they said, "Bill, have you seen Music Week, this trade magazine for the music business?" I said, "No." And they said, "Nightbird's album's gone in at number 4. I said, "Really? Is that good?" And they said, "It's good, it's good. You really need to give up your day job." And I said, "Yeah, but I've got a mortgage and I've got this and that." So it was only when I enjoyed the job so much that I didn't want to leave, really. And it was when we got invited to do a tour of Japan. We were going to be out there for 2 or 3 weeks touring in 1983, that I thought, I just can't do it. So I went to see the head of my group and I just said, "Look, I'm going to have to." He said, "I can't believe it's taken this long for you to keep staying the job." And I think because he used to give me a lot of time off to go and do gigs. So when I left the BBC, I think I owed them about 2 or 3 weeks leave.
Brilliant.
So finally I left. And you know what? It was really sad because I had such a good time there, especially the last few years. Made a lot of good friends. And I haven't thought about it for a long time, actually. But all my colleagues were really, really supportive, which was lovely, actually, because it could have been very much a different way. So very fond memories of those times.
I mean, there was a bit of a movement in this music at that period, wasn't there, with bands like Level 42, Incognito, Light of the World, all at the same time. Did that make it a much more exciting time? And was there an exchange between you and these other bands in sort of similar genre?
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, Level 42 and us, we we were signed to Polydor by the same guy, actually. So there was always a bit of competition between us. And as things went along, we'd hear what Mark had said about us, and we say about them and stuff. So there was a little bit of that going on, but we all kind of got on okay. And I love the fact that we were part of this. I guess they call it the Brit Funk movement, but it was kind of when I look back at it and I listened to some of our early records and some of the other bands, we were all influenced so heavily by Crusaders, you know, George Benson, Stevie Wonder, all Earth, Wind & Fire, all these bands. But somehow the Brit Funk, we had a different sound. It was less polished in a way. It was a bit scrappy in some ways, and it just kind of sounded sort of British, really, in a way. I mean, we were trying to emulate them, but we couldn't do it. So it turned into just all our own sounds, really, which was great. So there was an element of all doing this thing. And we'd see each other at different gigs and different venues. And like you were saying about Lee, you know, Imagination, we did some shows together. And we did some with Level 42. So there was a kind of a great sort of, I wouldn't say, what's the word?
Camaraderie?
Camaraderie, thank you very much. There was camaraderie, there was competition, but camaraderie, and thank you for that. I'll remember that word all day now.
You mentioned Japan and that you went off to Japan, but Shack Attack have had quite a connection to Japan. What was it about Japanese audiences, you think, that connected them to your music?
Well, the song Nightbirds, that was our second big hit in the UK, I think that song became a massive, massive hit in Japan. It was very, very popular. I mean, but at some point, Polydor guy said to us, you know, that it was selling, the album was selling as many copies as Thriller. You know, it really was huge in Japan. I think maybe the fact that it was sort of semi-instrumental helped in a way. There wasn't a language thing. So they'd hear the intro and they'd hear this little da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, you didn't have to worry about sort of not understanding the words or anything. It was just that melody. I think they like a good tune in Japan. And the one of the guys at the record companies had this wonderful phrase. And they said to me, he said, your music appeals to traditional Japanese sensibilities. And I thought, I don't really know what that means, but it's a great, great phrase to pull out now and then. And to this day, whenever we still go to Japan pretty much annually, and when we play the Nightbirds, it's still everybody's up on their feet. It just it's almost become like part of, I don't say part of their culture, but musically, it's a very well known song in Japan. So that was the song really that took us into Japan, and then from that we built on that and toured all over the country for many years, and it's still a place we love to visit.
Oh, that's brilliant. I mean, you had enormous success in that period in the 80s. I mean, Down on the Street was, of course, you know, one of the biggest tracks in that whole era. Did you actually decide to leave Shack Attack? For this is a bit blurry to me, because you started to do your own albums. I don't know if you left or it just sort of went onto the back burner.
No, not at all. I was I'd never thought about ever leaving Shack Attack. I still really enjoyed doing that. I just had the opportunity. We were doing the Down on the Street album, actually. We actually had a few days, because we were making a bit of money. So we decided it'd be nice to go to a residential studio because you could. So we went down to the south of France to a studio that was owned by wonderful jazz. He's sort of like he transformed Bach into jazz, Jacques Lussier. And he'd built this studio called Miraval, south of France, which now actually is owned by Brad Pitt. And it was a vineyard then. They've turned it into a particularly making rosé wine. I read about it now. They transformed the studio. But we went down there and to do about 10 days we were down there recording. We actually did some work, but we could have done a bit more. The wine there was very nice. Now, a lot of people were visiting from the record company. And it was a bit of a that kind of do. Playing, a bit like making a Jimi Hendrix album, where most of it was partying and some of the music. we weren't making Electric Ladyland, that's for sure. But anyway, so at the end of it, one of us said to Jacques, we said, that wine is fantastic. He said, we'd love to take some back. He said, well, we can't because you've drunk it all. So we actually drank a vineyard dry. Which is quite an achievement.
That's the best jolly ever, I think.
It was, yeah. Anyway, but so it was at that time that the record company guy said, we were chatting away over a glass of wine, and I was talking about, oh, I've got all these songs that we haven't been able to use for the album. He said, well, why don't you make a solo album? And I thought, we've had a bit of downtime and stuff, so I thought, great. So went to the studio that we'd worked at a lot. And I had a few months to work on the solo album with the songs that weren't picked to go on the Down on the Street album, because I had quite a lot left. And that's how it came about, really. So there was no question of ever leaving the band. It was just a sideline. It just happened to happen that, you know, there was one track on the album that the engineer that was working on the album, Nick Smith, who is Norman Smith's son. Norman was the Beatles engineer up to Rubber Soul. And he'd been working with Gary Numan. So we had this tune that I'd attempted to sing, but it didn't work. And we got Gary in to sing this song. It's a song called Change Your Mind. And that became a big hit off the album, which was, we didn't think there'd ever be a big hit. It would just be a solo album, you know, like a project you put out. He's done his solo album. Now he can get back to the band and stuff. That became quite a big hit. So that then had a little bit of legs and stuff. But
I mean, that was a genius idea, wasn't it? Because, I mean, it's sort of I watched, there's also that video actually on Top of the Pops as well, which I watched earlier.
Right,
and you know, the thing about the fusion of those, the two different styles, is something that worked really well. I just wondered what you feel, because when we meet people, we glean something from them. And I wondered what Gary Numan would have learned from you.
That's very, I'm not sure, really. The way we did it was, I mean, I'd actually, Nick and we it was just the two of us working, really, on or whatever synths and drum machines we could put together. And that particular song, we'd had the whole track finished. It was literally done. And we just sat there and thought, this is a fantastic backing track. and I'd attempted to sing it because I had the melody and everything. But obviously, it just didn't work. I'm not a great singer anyway. And he said, well, what about getting Gary to come in? You know, it might work, give it a go. And so we sent the cassette to Gary's dad. Tony was his manager. And they said, oh, that sounds great. So Gary agreed to come in and sing it. So literally, we did one or two takes. And when he sang it, we just sat back and thought, my God, it just worked. It was pure fluke. I mean, it could have had any other singer and it wouldn't have worked. But Gary just, and it was only one or two takes, and he sang it. And we just thought, wow, this is brilliant. And the A&R guy came down, and everybody listened to it, thought, this is pretty good, this track. You know, it had a great feel to it. It was sort of like I guess I was listening to, you know, sort of like electronic stuff, listening to all kinds of music. But it was the fusion of lots of mad sounds that we were doing when we were recording it, with a sort of, you know, that disco four on the floor beat. And then Gary's voice just took it to another place, because it's so unexpected that his voice would work on a track like that. So it was just, there was a lot of serendipity involved in that. And then we had it remixed. A wonderful American remix guy remixed it and then took it to another level. And then we ended up with the track, which was, and I have to say, I mean, I hear it occasionally on the radio and stuff, and I listen to it now and I think, that's actually pretty good. You know, still sounds production-wise. And I can't remember some of the stuff we did on it. I don't remember how we did it, but it was just, it was a fantastic experience.
I'm not name dropping, but another name that I talked to recently was Carl from Loose Ends. And one thing he mentioned to me was that America was a bigger audience for Loose Ends. And for you in the 90s, it was also a big audience for you. And what was interesting, because you worked with Don Grusin, didn't you? And this sort of full circle thing, you were into the Crusaders and then you're working with the guy who's worked with the Crusaders, you know, who's produced the Crusaders. So it's these sort of full circle things where you start off being a fan of something and then you're part of their sphere. How was that for you?
Weirdly enough, actually, last weekend I did a couple of shows with Don at the Pizza Express. We did a two piano thing. They were having a Steinway Piano Festival there. So, I mean, I've known Don now for like 30 years and become great friends, and obviously I've met his brother a few times, and who's legendary as well, and all the people Don's worked with. And it was, for me, it was just sitting there playing the piano with him was quite challenging, because those guys have been my heroes for years. So initially, when you meet people like that, I try not to show it, but you are a bit starstruck, really, because they've been such influences on you. Now I guess being a bit older and having worked with a lot of people like that, it's a different feeling. But in those days, it was just for me, it was just fantastic to see these people come through, but and try and be normal when you're chatting away and not say, oh, by the way, you know, you did that solo on that album at 2 minutes 30, you know, that's all the stuff you want to ask. You can say, oh yeah, you know, it's a fine man, you know, just be cool and all that stuff. And then, you know, sometimes people become friends and or not, whatever else. So, but yeah, they're really, what I did find about those guys, you know, the top guys, like, as you say, it's Joe Sava Crusaders. Generally, all those guys are just the nicest people. I mean, we did a few shows with George Benson over the years, and which is fantastic. Al Jarreau we work with, and they're just great people. You know, they're so talented. They've got nothing to prove. So most of the time, they're just lovely to work with and make you feel at ease, probably because they think, you know, well, they're working with us, or maybe they don't think that. But it was it's certainly... getting in, making, recording with those sort of people initially is kind of nerve-wracking, because you have watched and listened to them for so long. And it's inspirational, actually. And I've done, particularly working with Don a lot, I've certainly learned a lot from him, you know, in terms of jazz. Because I would never classify myself really as a jazzer. I know now to play the piano. I'm reasonably good at jazz pop stuff, but I'm not a real jazzer coming up through the jazz clubs and stuff. So firstly, it's lovely that they play, loved up to sort of play along with me, which is great. And also I can learn as well. So hopefully that's now made me, you know, I like to think I'm a better player. still lots of improvement to be had. That never stops. But I think that but Don certainly opened me into a world where I got to meet a lot of the people I'd admired for so many years.
I mean, I've got to jump now because we're coming to near the end and I want to talk about Lee John. And this album, in a sense, has a long history, doesn't it? Because you actually wrote a track with Lee, I think it was in the early 2000s.
Yeah, it was 20 years ago when he did a, he guested on a Shack Tank album. So that's where it all started. And then I have this habit of saying to people I meet, so I say, let's make an album, because I've worked with some pretty diverse people over the years, just because I love doing it, you know, all sorts of genres. And then we did that, and then sort of talked about it, and then we did a few tunes, and then he's busy, we're busy, and so it just went into the sort of sidelines for quite a few years. And then it was lockdown really was the key, when we decided that I had some more tunes, we had some old tunes, let's try and get this done. So I sent Lee a load of backing tracks that I had. he did vocals and wrote some melodies and stuff, and we kind of pieced it together through lockdown. And then we ended up with, I think, 8 or 10 songs, and we thought, this sounds pretty good, actually. A mixture of soul, jazz, you know, it's a real eclectic mix of stuff. And Lee, I mean, I have to say, I think Lee sings just as well as he's always done. His voice is still in really good condition. His obviously, people know his falsetto voice, but his baritone voice as well is, it's great. Whatever register he's singing in, he's vocally still fantastic. So he'd send me all these vocals that were just brilliantly mixed, and I just have to drop them into the track and hey presto, it worked brilliantly. So it's lovely in the fact that we've known each other since 1981, really. But then it's taken 20 years to do this album, and we sort of renewed our friendship, which is fantastic. So I'm very, very proud of the album we've done, even though it took so long to do.
I think it's interesting what you said about Lee's voice, because for the uninitiated about Lee's long career and the jazz music he's done and all that sort of thing, you do think of Imagination and you do think of this specific falsetto style. And then from this album, you really understand the quality and the depth and the breadth of his voice, which is Absolutely. Which is really interesting.
Yeah, no, and I think a lot of people don't realise that the sort of, as you say, the breadth of talent that he has in a lot of different genres. And so when we did the sort of more jazz influenced tracks, it was lovely to hear the way he put it all together, and it just seems so natural. Whichever way he decides to go, it's a great voice, high or low, really.
How was the working relationship? I mean, is there one person that leads it, or how is it just an organic process?
I think in terms of sort of putting it all together, production wise, I put it all together at my studio here. He would send me all his vocals. I did all the you know, there aren't any real drums on it. It's all, nowadays you can do everything really in this small space. I got some few friends. Weirdly enough, talking Level 42, one song, Mark King, I mailed Mark. I said, would you fancy playing on this track? So the song called Take Me Back, as Mark played the bass on that. So you sort of got Shack Attack, Imagination, Level 42 on one song, which is kind of nice, thinking of the conversation we were talking about earlier. And so I sort of put that all together. But Lee's input in terms of the lyric, he obviously wrote, I don't write lyrics, so he wrote all the words. A lot of the melodies, I had some, but he did a lot of the melodies and the harmonies. I mean, that's all Lee. He just sent me the finished product. So we worked, I did my bit, the sort of backing tracks, I guess, and then he'd drop in all the vocals, which were brilliant. So it really was very much a 50-50 effort, which I really enjoyed, actually, that creativity. And then I maybe suggest something and he'd say, try this and whatever. But in terms of a working relationship, I really enjoyed the project, and he's a lot of fun to be with. I mean, we laugh a lot. He's just fun. He's a fun guy, you know, and doesn't take himself too seriously, which is great. So there's just a lot of enjoyment and happiness, which I hopefully, you know, sort of shows through in the album.
I mean, you mentioned the track with Mark King. That is, of course, the single Take Me Back, and it's from the album Intimate Glow. Yeah. I mean, I really like that album. I thought it was it's really beautiful. And what interests me about that style of music and the style of music that you've been involved with your whole career, it's never been out. And I think, in a sense, there's an advantage of not being the, you know, you mentioned Top of the Pops and these pop stars who are really, you know, like get the full attention. Their careers are much more, you know, in a sort of roller coaster. And I feel that, you know, you've built a career which has a strong base and is ongoing. When you play today, do you find that you are also pulling in a younger audience?
Our audience, obviously, you know, you've got the fans from the day, which is great. But we do find that, you know, there are, you know, it's a real mixture. There's still quite a lot of young people that come along, either because their parents, you know, they had to listen to it, or they say they this might be becoming a bit more like their grandparents, but because they've come across it on the radio, wherever else. So it's still, I'd say, you know, fair bit of the audience is of our generation or a bit younger, but we're still pulling in sort of young people as well. So it's, which is lovely to see. You know, the fact that, you know, I try to listen to a lot of music that's going on today, you know, and jazz, you know, you see the lineups at the Pizza Express or Ronnie Scott's and what's going on online and stuff. So there's still an appetite for the sort of music we play. I guess you mentioned about, you know, solid sort of background and stuff, but I guess Shacktack we've never been considered to be truly hip. But weirdly enough, less in this country. When we go to Europe and to Japan and stuff, I think they have a different perspective of Shacktack music and stuff. This country, there was an element, you know, in the early days, a bit disco handbag kind of thing that we got a lot in the press and stuff. But the fact is, you know, we're still doing it, and now, amazingly enough, it's still the original lineup, which is fantastic. And also, I joke when we chat at the shows and stuff, saying that, you know, to have the original lineup is amazing because we're all still alive. Because it's getting to that point, you know, when suddenly you hear a bit of news, some so and so is not with us anymore. So, and I think because of that, you know, and Lee would probably say the same thing, that we enjoy touring and playing more than ever because there are limitations. You know, you don't think about it 40 years ago. It's just like, let's just get on with it. But nowadays, I think we truly appreciate how lucky we are, what we do, and the fact that we're still doing it.
Bill Sharp, it's been brilliant to talk to you. I must say, you mentioned disco handbag. I was a bit of a disco handbag in the 80s because I loved Shacktack. So I want to thank you for your creative contribution to the culture, because I think it's important to say to artists, because you really have been part of my life and you've been part of many people's lives. So thank you again, Bill, and I wish you much success in the future, and particularly with this album with the wonderful Lee John.
Well, that's lovely to speak to you. Thank you for saying that. Thank you.
Up there is an interview I recommend. Down there is where you can find all the podcast interviews, and here is where you can connect.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.